Thank you so much. Thanks, Ben, for having me, and thank you to Anne in particular for that wonderful paper that I feel very lucky to be invited to respond to. And I'm going to take up Anne's notions, which I think I'm going to track a little metaphor or route through her discussion of the death drive, and perhaps that seems a little bit antiquated to revive the death drive, but I feel that it's suitable and also makes a nice linkage between her Daniel Tiffany reference and some other materials that I'm going to bring in. So to begin with, I'm going to start with a few epigraphs to this response. The first is from the poem Friends by Michael Farrell in his most recent collection, Open Sesame, from Giramondo. I'm going to read an excerpt about a third of the way in. Alex's supervisor has published an essay that's a veiled paean to teacher-student romance. Horace is going to the zoo once a week to photograph elephant hide and doing readings of the wrinkles. Damon reappears as a vampire in Luke's short story, and Jenna sleeps with him, Luke. Luke's parents are thrilled to be having a grandchild and are texting names such as Titian and Forster to Jenna constantly. Max's poems improve and Luke's story gets rejected about four times. Scientists discover a giant Mars bar in Lake Burley, Griffin, and claim it's over 10,000 years old. Kenny's mother dies and he starts writing poetry. Gabby's writing another conference paper on the measuring of frenemy frenzies in friendship networks. It started off as parody, but quickly became all too meaningful. The second is a poem by Chris Edwards from Dear Sir Madam, which is collected in Out of the Box, Contemporary Australian Gay and Lesbian Poets, edited by Michael Farrell and Jill Jones, and I believe was originally published in Edwards's small chapbook, Utensils in the Landscape. It has been drawn to our attention that Oscar Panizza, the manifest content of the dream so ignominiously mistreated by that Viennese doctor, may in fact have been a glorified houseboy known to his peers as swine, sow, or hog. In this topsy-turvy world announced daily by your own dead father to his kingdom, he has been elected the recipient of your secret wish, and it is our duty to inform you that he now longs to dish it up to you in limbo. Return to Pretender immediately, was the next best way to describe my response as I tore myself from the letter in bits and the ground rushed steadily toward me. I felt drawn to the thought of not going along to this tryst they mysteriously wanted, but it was far too late, according to the experts, whose solution to the puzzle had by then passed, like pictographs passed through a plug hole. Like what? You heard me. Indeed I did. It was clearly intended as some kind of punishment aimed at his mother's penis. There was this woman, see, only she was me, squealed the good doctor, who'd berate me giddily, whereupon Oscar, receiver of stolen kicks, would mistranslate and disseminate the fabled lingo of entrapment and arrest. Who was he? I wondered, not without wanting to hold him in my arms and give him a damn good thrashing. Threshing machines would start up, and I'd go pondering the mist or something. The third is just one very small part of Gig Ryan's poem, If I Had a Gun. And it is. It's so small I can't even find it. Where are you, darling? I'd shoot the man that couldn't live without me. And then the fourth epigraph is from Lionel Fogarty. You have to understand all the poetry I write in order to get the message. It's a performance in literary oral tradition of even using their English against the English. The way we write and talk is ungrammatical because the way they write, I'm sorry, is write and talk is ungrammatical because it doesn't have any meanings in their spirit. More so, the cultural symbols that belong to my people are more significant to my people than the A, B, and C. What I want to achieve in my writing one day is to put Aboriginal designs of art inside the lettering to bring a broader understanding to the meanings of the text. Okay, throughout this short response, I'll be referring perhaps obliquely, but nevertheless directly to those four texts, which I hope will start to make their resonances and suggestions clearer. Recently, Anne and I have been in a kind of ongoing dialogue about the notion of alternative kinship relations and affinities and different kinds of relationships and networks of relations that are not predicated on the family or the state. And it's been a really productive conversation, and I think this Anne's paper and my response are part of that, interestingly, in a kind of public sense in this particular instance. And I recently watched a really fantastic panel which was packed with three kind of transatlantic goddesses, Avital Ronell, Elaine Sixou, and Judith Butler. And it was on just this alternative modes of kinship and what they were calling disruptive kinships and modes of relation. And Ronell really usefully gave this history of psychoanalysis as this phobic reaction to by Freud to Goethe's 1809 novel Elective Affinities. Apparently, in Ronell's words, Freud was so freaked out by the kind of display or by the theory or by the kind of almost fabled demise of relationships of the family and particularly relationships of marriage that novel set out, that he what he perceived in that novel story was what he was later to identify as the death drive. And he decided at once that he must kind of begin this lifelong study to dismantle what he saw to be the entropic or ill-fated relation of the marriage, which I think is really quite a fascinating history. Whether or not it's the truth, it doesn't matter because it's interesting. The novel itself is really peculiar because it comes from this. It's actually quite a kind of strange title because there's nothing elective about the affinities that Goethe sets out in this story. It comes from a scientific theory, which is that there are certain kinds of chemical relationships of attraction which have the tendency to find each other in the material or physical world. So that is to say, certain things tend to be attracted to each other and certain things tend to be repelled by each other, and that this is a kind of gives a sort of story of a little bit more sort of material conviction to relationships, which more than say a Lucretian or Epicurean model of atoms falling through the void and happening upon each other and making things. This is this kind of sense that there are these, in a sense, predetermined relationships, but who does the predetermination are these kind of chemical elements and not, in fact, those which become bonded by them. So in the novel, Elective Affinities, the idea is that these chemical relationships are also what bring humans into relationships, i.e. those who we find we have chemistry with. So romantic relationships are always this struggle and often a kind of ill-fated or failed or doomed struggle between the chemical desires for our material assemblage to bond with another and then those which are the responsibilities of the family, the state, the law, the economy, and all of those kinds of other institutional influences. So Freud saw this kind of picture of people's relationships bound by these predeterminations and thought that he could kind of develop, I guess, what becomes a theory of the libido. That, okay, yes, there are these chemical predeterminations, and I'm going to call that, I guess, in a sense, the libido, and I'm going to call that sense of doomed attempt to realize the insistence of desire by returning to a kind of pre-desire or kind of pre-relationship state as the death drive. And elsewhere, the death drive, I think, has been really usefully kind of defined in this way, not as some sort of destructive. I always used to think the death drive was basically just like that sort of like bender mentality, you know, where you just want to go out and get fucked up. And that sort of can extend over one sense of ontology. But in fact, it's quite a lot like what some of the phrases that Anne evoked in her paper, this kind of negative sociability, lyric obscurity, even to quote Hose from Anne's paper, this don't be difficult and don't be dead kind of sense, that it's this kind of continuation or insistence on continuation, which always has within it the kind of desire to return ex nihilo to some sort of state. I think Daniel Tiffany refers to it as a kind of living dead state. So what Freud does when after he's been freaked out by Goethe is he develops this kind of, not just this, the beginnings of the theories of the libido and the death drive, but he also institutes the family as the kind of governing body of this dysfunction. Then we have this kind of very exact and precise and in a sense calculated interpolation of the Oedipal relationship and triangle as this foundational failure of the family, and also as both the beginnings of and also the kind of answer to or diagnosis of the problems of relationship. So I think that's really interesting too, in a weird way, and you know, one never knows whether Freud was aware of his own sort of weirdnesses. He sort of identifies a problem by making the solution the problem ad infinitum. And so all of a sudden we have this kind of vision of the family as this particular kind of codependent dysfunction. Which took me to another interesting book which deals with kind of, I guess in a sense, various kind of modes of the death drive, which is Epistemology of the Closet by Eve Sedgwick, which has this fantastic introduction, which gives a really great account of the history of sexuality, both the text by Foucault and a kind of broader sense of that history itself. And she gives this kind of, echoing Foucault, she talks about, the kind of Victorian era interpolation of the homosexual male subject under law as this really specific moment of constitutive subjectivity, which I have 3 minutes. How is that even possible? Okay. Oh my God. So this constituent subjectivity, which is built at the exact time that there's this huge anxiety over empire. So what do we do when we have an anxiety over empire? Well, we kind of reinforce the family unit, and we outlaw the non-family outliers, and we assume that the miniaturization of the family unit will reproduce the state, even in this kind of schizophrenic global empire situation. So all of this is to say, and I guess in my remaining 2 minutes I will say this, my account of the work that Anne has just shown and the other examples that I've shown is that if we give up on, in a sense, the notion of blood as that which both ties us to race, to nation and to law, as well as to family and to relationships, then we have a better opportunity, in a sense, of dealing with the situation we find ourselves in now, which is one in which there is this kind of sense that if we assume that there will be some kind of progress-oriented teleological end to the mess that we're in, we might end up just getting further and further into that mess despite our best intentions. If we break with the notion of blood as that which ties us literally in these kind of bloodlines or linear kind of rivulets into the future, and if we kind of denounce, in a sense, not only nostalgia, as Anne suggested, but also our kind of blood's history, then perhaps we have the opportunity to do something along the lines of what the four epigraphs suggested, which is to kind of queer both the history, the present and the future of our relationships with each other, our text and our nation and our race. And that is, I think, very quickly in Farrell's work. I mean, he does this in a lot of ways, but I think one of the ways that he does it is by really valorizing intimate and familial and kin relationships with things other than the family and even the human. You know, Farrell's kind of genuine commitment to treats and pets and objects and pop avatars kind of suggests that there are these other kinds of relationships. Giggs, obviously, against the kind of violence of the patriarchy and those kind of implicit relationships. Also, the ambivalence then of the relationship. I cannot live without you. I must live without you. To echo Kate echoing Ingrid about nationhood. Fogarty, who kind of takes up, who suggests that which makes English un-English is in fact this kind of lack of grammar, where grammar functions as the sort of spiritual organization of material experience. And then finally, in Edwards, whose commitment to collage and mistranslation and a kind of great ironic tradition of turning language into these, giving language different histories and bringing them into the contemporary, would be four different poetic modes of doing that. Thank you very much.